Evidence and Answers begins right now.
This is Evidence and Answers radio broadcast with our host, Pat Zukeran. Pat is an author, teacher, and international speaker in the area of Christian apologetics, the defense of the Christian faith. Who was Thomas Aquinas, and why should Christians today care about this gentleman from the 13th century? Today we will explore the life and works of Aquinas and discover why he is one of the most influential apologists, theologian, and philosophers of Christian history and Western civilization. Now let's get right into our broadcast for today. Here's Pat and his guest, Dr. Richard Howe.
You're listening to Evidence and Answers, where we provide compelling evidence for faith and hope in Christ and biblical answers to the issues of today. Well, we've been studying the great apologists of Christian history, and one of the most influential philosophers and theologians in Christian history and in Western history is Thomas Aquinas, who lived from 1225 to 1274. He was a Dominican friar who's also one of the greatest philosophers and apologists, defenders of the Christian faith in church history. Well, who was this man, Thomas Aquinas? And why was he so influential in Western history? Well, to help us understand and gain insight on Thomas Aquinas is Dr. Richard Howe. Dr. Richard Howe is a writer, great public speaker and debater, speaks at conferences and university campuses all over the world. He is a professor of Christian apologetics and philosophy at Southern Evangelical Seminary, great seminary he'll be telling us about in South Carolina. He is also the Norman L. Geisler Chair of Christian Apologetics at Southern Evangelical Seminary there. So, Dr. Howe, welcome back to Evidence and Answers.
Dr. Zukeran, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Such an honor to be with you again. We've had several times together, not only remotely, but had the privilege of being in the wonderful state of Hawaii there. And so just good to hook up again.
Yes. And tell us about the Norman L. Geisler Chair of Christian Apologetics there. What's that all about?
Wow, what an honor. When I was a student of Norm Geisler back in the early 1980s at Dallas Theological Seminary in Dallas, Texas, if someone then had said, well, someday you're going to teach with Norman Geisler, or even more astounding, you're going to hold the chair, that would be like saying, you know, Ringo wants you to sit in with the Beatles for a while or something like that. I mean, I would have thought you are nuts, because he's been a hero, a mentor, almost like a second father to me over the decades since I first became his disciple back then. So he co-founded, as you know, Southern Evangelical Seminary, along with Ross Rhodes, who was the pastor at the time of Calvary Church in Charlotte, North Carolina. And they were a great match. Norm Geisler, the consummate philosopher and apologist, theologian, Ross Rhodes, a theologian and evangelist. And so together, their goal for evangelism, defending the faith and spreading the gospels, was great. And that's what SES grew out of in the early 90s. And so he eventually, towards the end of his life, they established a chair in his honor. Typically a chair, what that means, not always, but sometimes what it means, it's endowed, which is to say that a donor would give money towards the chair to pay the salary of someone to occupy that chair in their honor. So a lot of universities around the Anglo-American world, for sure, have chairs, the chair of this, named after someone honorifically. So they offered that chair to me at the seminary some years ago, and I just couldn't be more thrilled and honored to occupy that and try to carry on his legacy. As you know, that Norm Geisler was an anomaly in the sense that he was so committed to the philosophy of Thomas Aquinas, which we'll get into, and why that was an anomaly and in some respects still is today. We'll explore those, but yeah, it's just great. So I basically teach a lot of the apologetic courses, world religions, new religious movements, various electives, but also some of the philosophy. I teasingly say it's philosophy light, because it's the philosophy for the apologetics degree, because we have a philosophy degree. Mm-hmm. And then occasionally get to do some of the PhD courses. So I'm having more fun than I think I should be allowed to have.
Yes, I think they said you best represent the mind and heart of Dr. Geisler. You know, some people might wonder, maybe do you best look like, Dr. Geisler?
Well, definitely not in the sense that he actually had hair, okay, all the way to the end of his life. He went to be with the Lord in 2019. So already he's outpaced me in that and a lot of other ways, too. He was a rare breed in terms of his, you know, if you've ever heard his testimony, if you haven't heard it, look it up sometime on YouTube. You probably could find it somewhere because he got all the way through public high school without ever reading a book. Mm-hmm. And as a sort of to just have the last laugh, God turned him into a scholar with his life and ended up writing over 100 books before he went home. And so, just to be associated with him is just an honor because I think he's unparalleled in terms of 20th and into the 21st century in American, at least, apologetics.
Yes.
Just a phenomenal contribution. Defender of inerrancy, especially. He was a champion of that, which I want to be that as well, every opportunity as well to champion the inerrancy of the Bible. So he had a big influence on me, to be sure.
Well, one of the scholars that influenced Dr. Geisler, of course, was Thomas Aquinas. You know, when I sat down with Dr. Geisler, I think it was over breakfast one day, and I said, Dr. Geisler, what are the top five? Can you name me the top five authors who have influenced, your thinking and your life? And he said, Thomas Aquinas. And I said, who's number two? He said, Thomas Aquinas. I said, who's number three? He said, Thomas Aquinas. I said, who's number four? He said, Thomas Aquinas. So I said, okay, I'll tell you what are the top five books that have really impacted your life? And he said, Aquinas one, Aquinas two. Aquinas. That's how great an influence Thomas Aquinas was on Dr. Geisler. So tell us about this man, Thomas Aquinas. Tell us a little bit about him.
So as you said, he was born in 1225. So this will be what, the 800th anniversary? Is my math correct there?
Yeah.
Of his birth. The birth date is not, some books will have it 1224, some 1225, not really positive. They are certain of the day of his passing. In 1274. So last year was the, 750th anniversary of his passing. The thing is, this interesting, we need to get out, it's the elephant in the room here. In the Middle Ages, the 1200s and afterwards, Aquinas loomed very large. He wasn't the only voice, and his opinions weren't the only opinions, but I think it's fair to say he was a dominant voice in Christian thinking, theology, as well as philosophy. And we can get into this maybe as we go along, if you find it an interesting sort of side road to follow. But let's suffice to say here that his thinking and his influence continued into Protestantism more than a century after the Protestant Reformation, which is to say, whatever it is that's distinctive about Aquinas's thinking, it wasn't the points of contention that the Protestant reformers were having with the Catholic Church. But for reasons, again, that might be interesting as a side note, that influence of Aquinas began to wane in Protestant thinking. I think Protestants were a little bit more susceptible to opposing points of view than Catholicism was. But for whatever reason, his influence wanes so that by the time you get to the 17th century, maybe, it's almost gone. All that's to say that today, if a evangelical, as we call them in the U.S., you do a lot of international travel, I know, and I do a little bit, and I have to remind myself that that word evangelical might not mean exactly the same thing outside our U.S. context than it is in other places. So what we mean by evangelical basically is a conservative Protestant with a very high view of the authority of scriptures and the primacy of evangelism. And that high view, most of the time, is a view of inerrancy of scriptures, right? So that's what we mean. So if you mention Aquinas's name, and especially if you sort of give any hint that you're sympathetic to some of his thinking, a lot of conservative Protestants, evangelicals, will break out in a rash. And that's because in the 21st century, almost always, anybody that names the name of Aquinas is going to be a Catholic Christian and not a Protestant, and probably, for that matter, not even Eastern Orthodox. So it's understandable that contemporary evangelicals, and particularly in America, are nervous about that, because definitely there were some elements of Aquinas's theology that Geisler wouldn't have agreed with, and I know you and I wouldn't agree with, and such, just as the Protestant reformers didn't agree with, and that's what precipitated the Protestant Reformation. But there are elements in his philosophy, if I can make that distinction sufficiently, that I think are true and are good and should be embraced in service, not only good, sound Christian theology, but also, I think, good classical apologetics. So that's got kind of get that out of the way. And unless any of your hearers might be among those that are nervous to go, what are you evangelicals talking about this guy who's a Catholic? You know, I say, well, you know, he was Catholic for sure. Pretty much everybody was Catholic if you were Christian, if you weren't Eastern or if you weren't Muslim, right? Mm-hmm. There wasn't a whole lot of choices back in the 13th century. You know, you just were default Catholic, if anything, Christian. But that's different now, obviously. So there are things that we should take exception to in some of Aquinas' thinking, which we can talk about as well. But it's the philosophy and even more narrowly, the metaphysics of Aquinas. There are places where he imbibed in Aristotle's thinking, and then places where he augmented, corrected, expanded some of Aristotle's thinking to make his thinking to be Christian philosophy.
Yeah. So speaking of that, you know, what do you think is the most significant contribution of Aquinas to theology and philosophy? I mean, he is a giant in this arena.
Yeah. In a way, it's sort of like asking what is the most important leg on a stool? Mm-hmm. And you go, well, you know, or on a chair or whatever. And you go, well, in a sense, they all work in concert. So there are a handful of things that I think Aquinas' thinking, he's either was a pioneer of this sort of thinking, or he gave the thinking, which may have roots even in the church fathers, he gave it an impetus and a defense that's unparalleled. So here's just a few that I can throw out as options. There will be something down the road a little bit that I'd want to mention before we're done, which are some particular philosophical things that were unique to him that he brings to the table in the broader question of metaphysics. But before we got to something like that, I mean, you think of something like he had a solid view of the nature of truth. Now, that might not have been a big worry in the 13th century. Indeed, it probably wasn't all the way back to Aristotle, what we call the correspondence theory of truth, right? So that a statement is true if it corresponds to reality. So if I say it's snowing, it actually snowed on the Gulf Coast of the U.S. last week, if you can believe it. Some people's lifetime, that hadn't even happened.
Yeah.
But if you say it's snowing, then that statement would be true if, in fact, it's snowing in reality, and would be false if it's not snowing in reality. And there are a lot of ways to qualify. It could be snowing now and not snowing tomorrow. It could be snowing here and not snowing there, and that's all fine. But this idea of truth as correspondence to reality, while, again, it might not have been a big issue from Aristotle up through the 13th century, you and I both know, as I'm sure most of your viewers and hearers know, that it's under assault. Truth now is my truth versus your truth, mm-hmm. This sort of relativism about truth. I remember, by the way, speaking of Geisler, Christians, and yes, certainly, we were all used to, if you will, the specter of moral relativism. That had been going on before most of us were born. But I remember Geisler told the story in the early 80s where he's given a talk. I think it was probably something on the resurrection, maybe on the occasion of Easter. And he was at a secular campus, right, university campus. And when he got finished, this co-ed walks up to him and she says, well, that's your truth. That's not my truth. And that was his first encounter with this relativism about truth as a new thing on the block, new kid on the block. So correspondence theory of truth, and of course, the metaphysics that we can get into undo that. The idea of this is something that's near and dear to me is the whole idea of natural theology. So natural theology would be the notion that God has revealed himself, at least somewhat, through creation that is knowable by reason. In other words, there are truths about God that we can know that are true about God apart from Scripture. You know, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork, Psalm 19. Psalm 94 says the heavens show his righteousness, and all his people will rejoice. Romans 1:20 says the invisible attributes of God are clearly seen, being understood through the things that are made. And later in the argument, Paul brings up in Romans 2 about the work of the law is written on the heart. In Acts 14, when Paul appeals to human nature, when they drop down to worship him, thinking he was Hermes and then Barnabas was Zeus, and they said, no, we're of the same nature as you, and we're here to bring you the message of the God who's revealed himself, he appeals to creation. Mm-hmm. You know, he's made all this stuff and he's provided for us with food and seasons and things. So this appeal to creation. Notice in Job, when it finally, Job gets now called to the carpet and God's going to say, okay, let me answer you now. And notice, if you go back through Job, notice how many times what God appeals to is what God did in creation. Where were you when I made this and I did that? Where were you? Right? And so he's appealing almost exclusively, I'm trying to think of an exception, to what normal people with the faculties God has created us cannot deny. That the sun is shining on a clear day, that it's dark at night, that it's wet when it's raining, it's cold when it's winter. Those are things that you don't have to have a prophet or the Bible to tell you. Those are things you can know by virtue of being a human. So I think Aquinas really has a strong case to make about not only the fact that there's natural theology, but its content of the God of classical theism as it's come to be. And maybe the last thing to mention, and again, all of these we can unpack as much as we want, as much as you want, is what has come to be known too in intellectual history as natural law theory. And that's the idea that there are moral truths about that are true, that are knowable by reason, apart from special revelation. Certainly, the scriptures tell us things about God that we couldn't have known otherwise. The gospel, the Trinity, the second coming, the resurrection. These aren't really knowable if you just look at creation. But the fact that it's wrong to do certain things and obligatory to do other things, you see this all over the world. I teach the world religions course at the seminary, and it's astounding how much the world's religions are fairly unified in terms of these moral principles. Things like don't murder, don't steal. The elders should take care of the younger. The younger should be deferential to elders. Husbands and wives should be faithful. Those kind of things. You see it almost in every world philosophy and every world religion. And so it became known as natural law theory because in Aquinas' thinking, it was one of the means by which God would superintend nations, right? So I tell people when the occasion warrants, as an American, you and I don't have the luxury of time to wait until every American gets saved, and then let's talk about abortion.
Mm-hmm.
No, we've got to talk about this in some manner, irrespective of someone's belief or disbelief in God or the Bible. Well, that idea that there are moral truths that are accessible by reason has come to be known as natural law theory. And it's actually part of our heritage as Americans imbibed in our Declaration of Independence. When they broke away, when the colonists broke away from King George, they appealed to a higher law. These truths are self-evident. They're endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights and that kind of thing that defines the American experience. An American experiment as well. So you've got those, and you find this zenith in every one of these things. I think you find the zenith of thinking about that in the writings of Thomas Aquinas.
Yes. Now, one of the things you mentioned, and Dr. Geisler always mentioned this, is that Aquinas was able to reconcile Aristotle's philosophy with Christian doctrine. And if I understand it right, that seemed to be controversial in his time.
Absolutely.
How was he able to do that?
Yeah, and so it's rightfully controversial in as much as many defining truths of Christianity are explicitly rejected by Aristotle. Like, for example, Aristotle explicitly denied the survival of the soul after the death of the body. He explicitly denied creation, that there was a transcendent God who made the universe. He basically regarded the universe as eternal. While he had some understandings of the distinctiveness of humans among animals, that distinctiveness didn't come close enough to what we know to be made in the image of God and these kind of things. So it's understandable that in many quarters in the Middle Ages and the 13th century, Aristotle was verboten, not totally, not universally, but you had enclaves where his writings were considered out of bounds for the Christian to study officially in the universities. So you go, okay, so how could you take this pagan philosophy of Aristotle and turn it into the Christian philosophy that Aquinas's thinking is? And he does that. And he does it, I mean, the short answer is he does it by a particular kind of innovation that I would argue is, for all intents and purposes, unique in the history of ideas with him. And that was his particular understanding of the nature of existence. of what it meant to exist. Now, obviously, Aristotle would know the difference between a tree that existed last year but is gone now. So he obviously knew the difference, at least was aware of the difference between something existing and not existing. But you don't find anybody from the ancient Greeks all the way up into the Middle Ages where you don't find anyone with a philosophical treatment of what is it when we say something exists? Because we can think of things in terms of their essence as to what they are. I know what a dog is. If I said to someone, hey, I've got a tree in my backyard, everybody would know what I meant by that, even though I didn't say anything particular about it, except that it was in my backyard. Hey, whether it was deciduous or evergreen or flowering flower, neither, whether it was a little tiny sapling or a huge towering papaya or oak or whatever. I didn't say anything particular, yet the intellect is able to understand what essences are. So I know what a dog is. I know what a human is. I know what a cloud is. I know these things. But we can think of essences that don't have existence. I mean, you think of something like an extinct dinosaur, like a Tyrannosaurus Rex. You can know what it is, but know that it isn't, right? That it doesn't exist. So you go, okay, so there's something to be said about the difference between a Tyrannosaurus Rex and then an actual existing Tyrannosaurus Rex. You know, the Tyrannosaurus Rex part doesn't change, but something's different between them, between one that doesn't exist and one. We can also think of things that have never existed, like, say, a hobbit. They're always just imaginary beings, right? They're not real. Hobbits never existed and probably never will exist, right? So we can think of things, and of course, things that have essence but and still exist, like you and I as human beings and stuff. So exploring this, the sort of ins and outs of, okay, so exactly what is it about a thing when we talk about its existence? I would submit to your viewers and hearers that that is the central doctrine of Aquinas's metaphysics, is understanding his distinction, because what he'll do with it is show that if anything exists at all right now, then there must be something whose very essence is existence itself, what the theologians call supreme being, right? So God is not just a thing that has existence. We are things that have existence because we've been given existence by God and are continually sustained in existence by God. This is the way Aquinas would argue. But God is a being. It's not even right to call him a being, as if he's just another thing in the universe that happens to exist. We're saying, no, he's being itself, existence itself. Now, that may sound kind of peculiar, but what Aquinas will do with that is try to argue that what would a being whose essence is its very existence be like? And I submit for everyone's consideration that all of these superlative attributes of God that traditional Christian theism celebrate, omniscience, omnipotence, all-knowing, all-good, all-powerful, all of the omnis and stuff, they all cascade inexorably from this central doctrine that God is pure being itself. So I tell my students, I teach a course, in fact, teaching it this semester on contemporary atheism, where we go through various kinds of atheism, including the Cambridge Companion to Atheism as one of our texts. Mm-hmm. And I think atheism is not merely false. I think it's absolutely incoherent, because in this classical model, as I sometimes, some people might refer to this Aristotelian Thomistic tradition, in that classical model, if someone said God doesn't exist, it's really tantamount to saying nothing exists, because nothing could exist unless there was something whose very essence was to exist itself, which is what he argues. So Aquinas' cosmological argument is more than just, and I like all these others, by the way, but it's more than just, hey, we've got fine-tuning in the universe that looks like an intelligent designer. I think those are great arguments, and they're easier to make than maybe the metaphysics.
Once again, we've run out of time. Thank you for joining us here on Evidence and Answers. Our goal is to bring you the love of Christ and to equip you in your faith to always be ready to give a response. If you would like to hold an apologetics conference or series of teachings at your facility, contact Pat by calling him in Hawaii. That number is 483-0586. Or you may email him through the Evidence and Answers website. That's evidenceandanswers.org. Be sure to browse through our listing of topics on our site. We have everything from atheism to Zen Buddhism. You will also find articles and additional audio for you to listen to or download. An additional location to find Pat's messages is on YouTube. Look up Evidence and Answers and hit the subscribe button. To keep quality broadcasts like Pat's on the air, we rely on generous financial support from you, our listeners. Donating is simple. Just log on at evidenceandanswers.org. Evidence and Answers is grateful for one of our sponsors, the Honolulu Christian Church. If you don't have a home church and are looking for a place to grow in your faith, check out the Honolulu Christian Church. For service times, log in at honoluluchristian.org. Join us again next time on the air or online as we provide compelling reasons for faith in Christ. That's Evidence and Answers with Pat Zukeran.